This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello there. Welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, the founder of MrDad.com. Everyone with children realizes that parenting is the most important yet most difficult work we do. But how do we maintain our adult lives and responsibilities and still meet our children's ongoing need for love and connection? Striking a balance between being attentive to your child and attending to your own needs is not a choice that's mutually exclusive. According to our guest for this part of the show, and in her new book, which we're going to be talking about today, she's going to share some tools and advice for strengthening the parent-child bond and minimizing the power struggles, especially in those very early years. During the demanding toddler stage, the nature of the parent-child bond shifts and parents no longer attend to the child's every need as they did during infancy. This is a critical time because parents establish lasting patterns with their children. The great task for us is to support our kids in learning to control their impulses and in being responsive to our requests. The good news is that raising a child you enjoy being with is highly likely with a few tweaks to your approach. Parents who are both responsive and have high age-appropriate expectations achieve better buy-in from their kids than parents who use authoritarian or overly permissive approaches. We'll start talking about raising joyful toddlers and preschoolers when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
This message is for all of you sitting in the passenger seat. And apologies if it gets a little uncomfortable, but how does it feel to be at the mercy of someone who thinks a random text is more important than your life? Someone who takes their eyes off the road while speeding along in a 3-ton hunk of steel. Freaky, right? Well, why not just ask them to stop? Or better yet, volunteer to text for them. It might be a little awkward, but believe me, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
I put out way too much trash to think about recycling. I just don't get it.
Some things are very obvious, Maria.
Learn the difference between trash and recycling and more on our website, YouGottaBeKidding.org. Visit YouGottaBeKidding.org today.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Faith Collins, who's the author of Joyful Toddlers and Preschoolers, Create a Life That You and Your Child Both Love. Faith, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, aren't toddlers and preschoolers joyful enough already?
Yes, toddlers and preschoolers are inherently intense, and that intensity shows up both in their joy and in their anguish and in every emotion that they have.
So what's the best part about them, do you think? Is that it? Their intensity?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's really the heart connection that we have with young children, or that young children just open their hearts so completely to us that, you know, I think often for many of us, this relationship with this little being is the deepest that we have ever had, and they can teach us so much.
You start off the book by talking about transforming no into yes, the link between connection and cooperation. And that, I think, is probably when people think either if they're up to their ears in toddlers and preschoolers now, or they can remember back to when they had them, that's one of the things, is the beginning quest for independence and obstinacy and refusal, and it's makes good sense why a researcher years ago called it first adolescence, those years. So what is it about that we want to start transforming them before they've even really had a chance to develop?
Yeah, well, you know, that quest for independence is a really important piece, developmental piece that happens in early childhood. However, we often, as parents and adults, attribute every no to that quest for independence. And I would disagree with that. I suggest that what if instead we translate most of the time that children say no, what they're really trying to say is, I don't feel as connected to you in this moment as I wish I did. And when we translate in that new way, our responses can be much different, right? And this is why, if we think of it in this way, this is why when we turn what we ask into a game, that no can melt away. It's not because our children suddenly don't need to be individuals, right? When we're not tricking them, we're responding to their request for connection, and when we're responsive to them, they can be responsive to us more easily in return.
All right, well, let's take an example of that. So put your shoes on. We got to go. No.
Right.
And flop down and throw a tantrum. So how is that a quest for connection?
Right. So say you get that, you know, time to get your shoes on. And often, especially in those time to get your shoes on times, we are often really distracted. We've got a lot of things that we're keeping track of. We have to collect a lot of different things. To take with us, plus we have a child, and we want them to just do it on their own. We're often not feeling very connected to them, and they're not feeling connected to us. But when we get that no, and instead of saying, come on, I don't want to have to ask you again, we say, oh, no, you don't want to get your shoes on. Where should I put these shoes? Maybe they go on your ears, right? Oh, no, maybe they go on your elbows. Many parents know that if they turn into that game, first they get a little giggle, then maybe they get a run around, and then those children are then happy to put those shoes on. And we're using those games. We're not using those games to say, oh, well, actually, you don't have to get your shoes on. We are using them to help our children say yes to us.
And that's all about let's play.
Let's play. Well, and, you know, children, we can tell that a child is feeling connected when we get that again. Right? Let's do it again. And play is a big one, but you can also do it through affection, through pausing to give a big hug, through humor, through movement. A lot of children feel really connected through movement. And we often, this is kind of an underutilized way of connecting with young kids. And through singing and songs. And I actually come up with a little phrase in my book. I say, if you want to connect with your child, don't forget to smile. Sing, S for singing, M for movement and touch, I for imagination, L for love and affection, and then that E for exaggeration and humor.
Okay. That's very cool. Okay. All right. So that's the beginning of it. And then
yeah.
We talk about maintaining connection through tantrums and meltdowns, which is another common element of the whole preschool and toddler years. Are they also expressing a desire for connection when they're doing that? Is just an even bigger desire for connection, or what's going on there? I mean, there's some of that. I mean, as parents, you eventually figure out a lot of, well, they're throwing these tantrums. It's always in the grocery store. It's always in the produce aisle, or it's always between 3 and 5 o'clock or something. You know, you learn to work around some of these things.
Right.
But sometimes they're not. They're just almost by definition irrational.
Exactly. Well, and sometimes, you know, it's there because they're overstimulated or they're tired or, right, all these things that we can figure out. But other times, you know, kids will, if you're having tantrums again and again and again and again, and that our bids for connection kind of aren't making much of a dent, then it's often that children are trying to tell us in the only way that they know how that something in their life is out of balance. And so it might be, you know, in families that I've worked with, it might be that kids are sending out a call for affection. Right, and that if we just do a bit of a pouring in the love, that those behavior issues can melt away. Other times, they're a call for boundaries, right? And in those cases, when we pour in that love, then they just up the ante. And that's often a, you know, mom, I need you to be, I need you to hold a firmer, you know, to hold more boundaries. I don't want to be in charge in the way that I'm feeling like I'm in charge. Other times, other calls can be a call for consistency and also a call to slow down. If there are too many transitions in their life and too many different caregivers, too much variation in schedule, right, that can be, it's really challenging for kids. And kids will tell us by acting out regularly that it's not working, something's not working for them.
Well, how do you tell the difference between those things? between the I don't want to be in charge and the other kinds?
Yeah. So a technique that I kind of alluded to it, but I'll spell it out more clearly.
Okay.
I really suggest doing a week of what I call a pouring in the love campaign. And when you're pouring in the love, you are just doing everything you can to connect with this kiddo. You're making their favorite foods. You're, you know, getting their, doing things because, you know, I chose this one because it's your favorite color. And they can be your special helper. And you're making eye contact and you're smiling and you're just doing everything you can. And then you see what happens. And, you know, oftentimes, much more often than we would can possibly believe, children just relax, like, oh, thank goodness. This is what I've been longing for. And in that case, you know, keep it up. And it doesn't mean that you have to pour in the love for, you know, forever, do everything that they ever want and connect as much as possible. You will settle into a new normal, but it's a new normal where you enjoy one another more. But other times, kids respond to this pouring in the love with just upping the ante, throwing bigger fits, making unreasonable demands. And those are, you know, if your child will only buckle herself into her car seat if you stand outside the door with the door open and look while looking away and not looking at her, this is a hint that that she is giving a call for boundaries, right? And that she needs you to be really more of a leader in the relationship.
And those kind of situations, though, it seems like if you know that she'll only put the seatbelt on if you turn the other way, doesn't it seem easier just to turn the other way rather than try to figure some other way to force her to do it if you know what'll work?
Yeah. So yes, in the moment it is. And if that's working for you guys, then that's fine, right? Like, lots of parent and kid pairs have little rituals that work for them that another person might be like, huh, that's a little funny. but if this is kind of a symptom of a child feeling too much in the driver's seat, then you know, children often say they're feeling a little, like, too much in charge by making increasingly unreasonable demands.
Okay.
And then throwing a fit when those demands are not met. And if those demands are met, they'll up the ante and demand something even more.
Right.
And so that's a sign that it's a request, you know, a call for boundaries.
Faith Collins is the author of Joyful Toddlers and Preschoolers Create a Life That You and Your Child Both Love. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will keep talking to Faith about toddlers and preschoolers.
It's Practical Polly Radio. I've switched to cooking with healthier oils. So now what do I do with all these tubs of lard? Skinny jeans feeling too tight? A bit of lard on your hips and thighs and those pants slide on like a dream. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils, like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Broad. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Faith Collins, who's the author of Joyful Toddlers and Preschoolers. And we were talking about kids and making unreasonable demands and increasing things and the way that they have of being in the world. And I want to move on to part three of the book, which is about self-regulation. And I think in many ways, I was talking with somebody a little bit ago about that may be one of the goals of parenting, is to get them to make good choices and to do things, to do the right things when we're not there. And it starts even in the toddler and preschool years, as we want them to be able to exist without us in a way and function well without us. So how does that fit into the whole self-regulation thing? What are they regulating, and how can we get them to do it in a way that doesn't take so much effort from us?
Yeah, I think, you know, children, I mean, toddlers are really, they are really starting out in this self-regulation journey. And so they're learning to regulate their emotions. That is a really big one. And so helping, giving children tools for being able to control or affect their level of arousal, right? Learning to recover from disappointment, to decide to focus on something else. That is a really powerful tool that we can give to our kids. Other tools, other pieces of self-regulation are attentional regulation, so following through on what they set out to do or what we're asking them to set out to do. So you can say, please take your plate, and they take their plate, and it ends up in on the counter or in the sink where it's supposed to be. And then finally, that impulse control is, you know, controlling one's actions, even when you want to do something. So inhibiting actions. All of those are so important, and I really dive into, well, how do we, you know, what are things, practical things that we can do to help our children develop these skills in ways that foster relationship and are not just kind of pushing, you know, putting them under our thumbs.
Okay. Can you give us an example of something like that?
So, yeah. So one of the ways that we can help children with this attentional regulation or follow through is by having really consistent routines. And we often, you know, we know that children learn through doing and they learn through imitation, but we don't think about if we do things in the same way every time, then children are able to gain mastery much more quickly than they otherwise would. And so, you know, a lot of parents say to me, but Faith, I hate doing things in the same way at the same time in every single day. Like, it feels so constricting. But, you know, when we can stop focusing on what has to happen, we can focus on how. And when that how becomes wonderful, then we can stop focusing on the how it's happening and focus on the relationship. And that's really where things can start to roll along, that children can really be proud of gaining mastery of every part of their day, and that we can really increase our enjoyment of one another. Does that make sense, or was that too vague?
A little vague. That's all right. I want to actually talk about delayed gratification, though, because which fits in here a little bit. You mentioned one of my favorite studies, the marshmallow study, where the kids were told that they could have one marshmallow now or two if they waited a little bit. And after signing up, how many years was it? It was decades. They followed up with these kids. And the kids who had the ability at the toddler preschool age to delay gratification were much more successful in life than those who couldn't. And
yeah, and in many areas, in their careers and academically and in relationships.
Yeah. So how do you begin to teach that? That was something that was a little bit of a weak spot in the whole research, was that they just said, well, this is the way that it is, as opposed to...
Right, and you
okay,
just think that, oh, well, your kid is either born with it or they're not.
Yeah,
right?
But apparently you can teach it. That when they asked these kids, that they were some of them were doing with, I think what they called putting a frame around it. They like put the marshmallow into as if it were a piece of art, and they could imagine it that way. But how do you teach kids to delay gratification and accept some, you know, more later when they're 2 years old and it's all about feed me now?
Yeah, well, that was one of the things I was really surprised about when I dived into that research, is the how. How did children resist? And what they found was the children who successfully resisted that marshmallow on the table for 15 minutes were children who decided to focus on something different, right? And so instead of just sitting there and watching that marshmallow and thinking about how much they wanted it, they would go into another corner, right? Or like they would arrange, you know, little sticks in a figure, or, you know, they'd find kind of anything. They had to stay in one seat, but they would kind of twirl their hair, pick at their toes. Like, you know, they would find something else to do. And that's something that we absolutely can teach our two-year-olds to do, right? They want something now. And you say, oh, yes, I'll help you as soon as this dish is washed and I dry my hands. What will you do while you wait? I know, maybe you could pick up I think the baby might be crying because she's lying on the floor. And so then you help them to find something else to do, but then you pull them back. Look, now I've dried my hands. You waited, and now it's your turn. So you draw them back to this idea. You don't just distract them away from it, but the idea that you can choose to do something different and that that reward pays off. That's something that we can do many times throughout the day with young kids.
And what about resilience? That's in a way, it's a similar kind of a thing, is that if you can't wait to get that second marshmallow, you're dealing with disappointment because you're not going to get the second one. But there's also going to be, throughout life, there are going to be all sorts of times when you're not going to get what you want when you want it, or you're going to get something that you definitely don't want. But you've got to recover from that. And how do we give them the skills? Again, it's part of the self-regulation in a way, the mm-hmm. skills to be able to deal with adversity at age 2 or 3.
Yeah, and, you know, this idea of resilience of, like, how do we recover when things don't go our way? What do you do when you're disappointed? And I think that, you know, how do you deal with anger when we're angry? And I think one of the things we can do, especially with anger and emotional regulation, we can talk about, like, we can model when we start to get annoyed, what do we do? You know, oh, that makes me mad. I'm going to take some deep breaths. Or I'm going to go get a drink of water. And then you go get a drink of water. Wow, I feel better. Right? What else should we do? What will we do next? And another thing you can do is help. You know, we often are told that naming children's emotions will help them. But I find with toddlers that that focusing too much on their negative emotions can really amplify those. And so rather, you know, say you're upset, you're crying, you really wanted that. You can say yes to their desire. You are, wow, you really wanted that. I wish I could give that to you too. What would you do if we had 100 of those, right? Who would you give them to? You can say yes to, in imagination, to that desire and help them move on to something, you know, to a new emotion. So that those are type of ways of dealing with emotional regulation. And recovering from disappointment, that if we have really a moment of real compassion that can be just through a hug or even silent, and then we can help them to focus their attention on something different. But we're not, you know, with a one-year-old, that is a little bit of a song and dance. But with an older toddler or preschooler, we're really choosing to focus on something else, even though it's not as good.
We only have just a minute left. What is your most frustrating part about dealing with toddlers and preschoolers?
I think it's both a blessing and a curse, is that toddlers, you know, they will always give us a chance to try again. And so if we have something that we are not good with that really pushes our buttons, or we have unresolved issues, our children will find those, and they will hold a mirror up for us. And so it's an opportunity for growth, but it often feels very uncomfortable in the moment. And I have a 3.5-year-old of my own, so I have worked with other people's children, and working with your own child is a whole, it's the same, but it's also different, because it really calls up your own issues.
Faith Collins is the author of Joyful Toddlers and Preschoolers, Create a Life That You and Your Child Both Love. Faith, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You wanted to see me?
Yes, please, have a seat. So here's the thing. When this company brought you on, we took a chance on you. You didn't have that 4-year college degree we typically look for.
Right.
But we gave you a shot anyway. And since then, you've worked incredibly hard and given it your all.
Thanks.
You've been an important asset to the team, but I don't think you can be an intern here anymore. We want to hire you.
You're serious?
Absolutely.
Find your next great employee. Introduce yourself to the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
I won't let you down.
I know.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and it's time for an Ask Mr. Dad question. Dear Mr. Dad, my baby is 4 months old, and my wife has been breastfeeding her since day one. She thinks it's about time for the baby to start eating real food. What are the best foods to feed her, and how do we start? Hold on. First of all, 4 months is too soon to wean your baby. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that infants have nothing but breast milk for 6 months. After that, it's okay to gradually phase out the milk and phase in some food. Those 2 extra months are really important. Several studies have found that babies who were breastfed for 4 months were twice as likely to develop pneumonia and 4 times more likely to develop ear infections than babies who were breastfed for 6 months. So don't quit now. Keep in mind that making the switch from breastfeeding to solid food is a process, which means that you and your wife will need to be patient. At the very least, it'll take a few days for your baby, who's had nothing but breast milk so far, to get used to any new textures and tastes. At the same time, she'll have to figure out how to use her tongue to get that gooey stuff from the front of her mouth all the way to the back to her throat, where she can swallow it. Liquids generally manage to make that journey all by themselves. You'll also need to introduce new foods one at a time. That will help you pinpoint the source of any allergic reactions. Throughout this process, solid foods should augment, not replace, breastfeeding. Here's how to do it. Your baby's first food should be a single-grain cereal. Oatmeal, barley, or rice. Those tend to be the least allergenic foods. For the first few days, add breast milk or formula, but not cow's milk, to make the cereal especially liquidy. Get the kind that's finely ground for babies, not the kind you'd eat yourself. Keep your camera handy to record some amazing faces that you're going to see. Offer new foods at the beginning of the meal when your baby is likely to be at her hungriest. 3 days after you successfully manage to get some cereal down your baby's throat, start adding pureed vegetables, one at a time, 3 to 5 days apart. Make sure she gets a good mix of yellow, like carrots and squash, and green, like peas and zucchini. Stay away from bananas, though. They're easy to mash up, but they're also very sweet, and your baby may like them so much that she'll refuse to eat any other new foods. After a week or so on veggies, add in some non-citrus fruits, pureed, like applesauce, one at a time. Again, 3 to 5 days in between. Throughout this process, no juice. It's basically pure sugar. At some point, introduce yogurt. It's a good source of protein and can easily be mixed with other foods. If your baby doesn't like yogurt, you may be able to trick her into eating some by putting a blueberry or some other treat at the back of the spoon. Breads and cereals are next. At about her first birthday, your baby will be able to eat any kind of table scraps, but in very small pieces. One big warning. Do not give your baby honey or corn sweeteners for at least the first year. They may contain tiny parasites that an adult's digestive system can handle with no problem, but an infant's still immature system just isn't up to the task. If you've got a question or a comment for us here at Positive Parenting, drop us a line through our website, MrDad.com. We love to get your comments, and we try to respond to as many of them as we can. We'll be back next week with another segment for you. Hey, but don't go quite yet, because there's a lot more of this Positive Parenting show coming right up.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm going to keep ticking, but no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times, when we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while? Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave. But unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. This is the second half of our show, and I'm Armin Brott, the founder of MrDad.com. Early childhood education in America is at a crossroads. Cutting-edge research is showing that preschool is crucial for all children to gain the academic and emotional skills they need to succeed later in life. A child's brain develops faster during these essential early childhood years than at any other time, and children who attend quality pre-K programs develop better language, literacy, problem-solving, and math skills, and are more likely to display stronger self-control. But even with this overwhelming evidence, too many children don't get this educational leg up. For many parents, enrolling their child in a pre-K program means relying on winning a coveted lottery spot. And for even more parents, having access only to low-quality programs means that their children don't get the good start they need. So the biggest and most urgent questions that we have to deal with right now are, what do our little learners need in the earliest years of school, and how can we ensure that they all have access to it? And that's exactly what we're going to be focusing on in this part of today's show. What works, what kind of support and training teachers need, what it really takes to implement a high-quality program, and why so many districts are struggling. It all starts when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
As an 18-year-old, I let my mistakes kind of take over my life. I was 0.5 credits away from completing high school, and I didn't do it.
10 years later, at age 28, Jackie finished her high school diploma.
When I found out that I was pregnant, I know that I had to do something for myself if I wanted to make her a better person and provide a better life for her. My family never stopped pushing for me to be better because they knew what I could become and who I could become as a person. My support team is amazing. The educational director, my sister, and even my 7-year-old daughter has just been more than the support that I could ask for. I've been given an opportunity, and I'm just thankful for it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is Suzanne Bouffard, who's the author of The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children. Suzanne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Is pre-kindergarten just 1 year?
No. Pre-kindergarten is in many ways a catch-all phrase that can mean a variety of things. Preschool, nursery school, early child care, pre-K, all of these terms mean roughly the same thing. They mean the couple of years that precede kindergarten. In some cities and in some programs, pre-K is used to refer to the year before kindergarten. And in some places, it's used to refer to 3- and 4-year-olds. So it can really be a wide range. And when I talk about pre-K, it's pretty much interchangeable with the word preschool.
Okay. So give us a little bit of a sense of the difference between kindergarten and pre-kindergarten and what pre-K is. I mean, because kindergarten, it seems like there's a much more organized system for that, that schools have kindergarten, that all the schools, all the elementary schools are always K through 5 or K through 8 or something like that. So we all know about the K part. But, and there are people who specialize in that, who have degrees in early childhood education. But the pre-K, you use so many different words that some of them sound like they might not have the same level of education or experience in teaching that a K and above person would.
The preschool landscape is a real patchwork. It's very varied across the country and even within one community. Now, for the most part, most places offer kindergarten. In many places, kindergarten is still voluntary, but it is guaranteed to any child. And for the most part, most people participate in public kindergarten or private kindergarten. Pre-K is different. There are some publicly funded pre-K programs, typically for four-year-olds, sometimes also for three-year-olds. But there's a larger private market for preschool programs that goes anywhere from birth all the way up to kindergarten. So in any given community, like in the city where I live, there are some programs in the public schools that you can enter a lottery to try to get one of those spots. There are also programs that are run by the Department of Human Services in the city, and there are a wide range of private programs. Across the country, we also have programs that are specifically dedicated for children from low-income families, particularly Head Start, which has been around since the 1960s. But it's very confusing because these pieces are all separate, and so there's no one place that a family can go to see what their options are. And there's no guarantee that there will be a spot for you free of charge the way that there is for kindergarten.
And there may not even be programs that are available free of charge anyway, you're saying?
Yes, exactly. So most states now have some form of a publicly funded pre-K program. Only about seven states don't have any state-funded pre-K. But that doesn't mean that every community in the state has it, and it doesn't mean that everyone is eligible. So some programs, like in Washington, D.C. and New York City, are open to all four-year-olds, or in the case of D.C., all three-year-olds. But in other places, they are means-tested, which means that they are only open to or have a priority for the lowest-income families who would have the hardest time affording pre-K.
Okay, so why do people want to send their kids to this?
There are many benefits of pre-K for children and for families and for society at large. So first and most importantly, children get so many things out of a quality pre-K experience. For many kids, it's their first introduction to formal school, and it's a great way for them to learn how to be learners. They can get all kinds of experiences that they wouldn't necessarily get at home, and some of that has to do with the curriculum and the activities and the things that teachers teach them, but also a lot of it has to do with the social aspects, like how to be part of a group, how to follow routines, how to wait their turn. And some of those situations are things that simply don't come up at home or don't come up just with your neighborhood friends. For example, having to get along in a large group of people or in a group of people that you might not choose to spend time with otherwise. And so in the ideal high-quality classroom, it's a low-stakes and fun way to get used to school and get excited about school and learning that encourages kids to be curious. Now, for families, certainly helpful in terms of supporting working parents to allow them the opportunity to have their children somewhere that's not only safe, but that's enriching and stimulating while they work. And in some of the newer studies that are looking at publicly funded pre-K programs, we're seeing that impressive percentages of families say that they are able to voluntarily enter the workforce or increase their hours because they have the preschool for their children.
Okay.
And then the third piece of that, I'll be quick. The third piece of that is that we now see that there are economic benefits for society in the long run when children go to preschool. It saves society anywhere between like $3 and $10 for every dollar invested because kids who go to pre-K are more likely to be successful in school in the short term and long term, and they're also more likely to graduate from high school, have well-paying jobs, and stay out of jail and the welfare system.
I mean, that sounds incredibly impressive, but how does this mesh with a trend that's happening now, which of people holding their kids back to start kindergarten later, for example, so now that instead of starting at age five, starting in kindergarten, a lot of people are waiting until age six, or they're having them repeat kindergarten, things like that. Is that a problem?
I think that trend is driven by a few factors. One is that there's some evidence that kindergarten is becoming the new first grade. that kindergarten is a more structured, a little bit more pressure, more of a high intense experience than it used to be 20 or 30 years ago. And so I think that some families are wary about putting their children at age 5 into that setting, and they would rather keep them in a pre-K environment, which they feel might be more developmentally appropriate. And I think the growing availability of pre-K programs is allowing families to make that choice if they feel that that's what's better for children. I know in some communities and in some families, there is also a feeling that it benefits children to be physically larger or more mature compared to their peers when they start kindergarten.
Right. That's a big concern, which is, I think, why a lot of people are doing. But I want to get back to this question of preparation and training. If we're going to have more pre-K programs, and you're making a compelling case for why we should, does there have to be a whole new diploma system that's set up or an educational system so that we can train them? Because it seems like the kinds of skills that you're talking about kids learning at those ages are not the same as they're learning in elementary schools.
That's right. And it's not just that the skills they learn are different, but the way they learn is different. So young children have to learn in a very hands-on and playful way. And a lot of successful pre-K is about finding teachable moments and engaging children in conversations and knowing how to redirect misbehavior. You don't simply send a four-year-old to the corner, and certainly don't send them to detention. So you have to understand how their brains are developing and what you can do to help them change their behavior in a positive way. And because pre-K is so diverse and it's such a patchwork, the qualifications and the quality of teachers really vary. So as we're seeing more and more pre-K programs in public schools, typically teachers in those classrooms are required to have a bachelor's degree and are often paid around the same salary ranges as other elementary school teachers. That's not the case in the community, and there are very wide discrepancies in how much teaching experience, how much training, and how much compensation teachers have. In writing the book, one of the things I was most surprised to learn is that half of our country's early childhood educators are paid so little that they're eligible for public assistance programs like welfare and Medicaid. So that just gives you a sense of how little the average provider in the community is being paid. And given that, you can imagine that the average four-year degree graduate who may have student loans or has invested quite a bit in their education simply can't afford to go into preschool and childcare teaching. So it's not necessarily attracting the best prepared group of people. So it's a real patchwork. Some teachers are very well trained and excellent, and some are really struggling, and there's a lot of turnover in many centers. So we do need to get to a place where we have a better and more coherent system of training teachers, and that needs to be part of a larger system that also compensates them better so that we can recruit and retain the best possible people to teach young children.
Talking with Suzanne Bouffard, who's the author of The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will keep talking to Suzanne about this and some of the more specific things about what a program looks like and how we can get one going if you don't have one near you. I'm Armin Brandt. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
Peek-a-boo. Peek-a-boo. Smile.
Smile, buddy.
Come on. Smile. Oh, honey, he's still not smiling.
Maybe he's not a smiler.
Yeah, maybe he's just not a happy baby.
Maybe he's just being a boy. You know how boys are.
Or maybe he's teething. Oh, poor baby, I think his gums hurt.
Maybe he's just tired.
Or maybe his tummy hurts. He didn't eat that much.
Maybe he's not ticklish.
You think maybe he's scared of the dog?
Maybe he'll outgrow it. Maybe it's a phase. Maybe he just doesn't like smiling.
Maybe he has autism, and we can definitely do something to help.
Maybe is all you need to find out more about autism. No Big Joyful Smiles by 6 months is one early sign. Learn the others at autismspeaks.org/signs or see a doctor today for an autism screening. The sooner it's diagnosed, the better. And it can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Broad. If you're just joining us, talking with Suzanne Buffard, who's the author of The Most Important Year. And I want to get back a little bit to your goal would be to have something like a pre-K program in an organized fashion available to everyone everywhere.
And that's right.
So how do you explain or get people to at least buy into the idea that it's going to recoup the investment 3 to 8 times or 3 to 10 times more, whatever it is that you're putting into it, is one thing. And then another part of it is, as you touched on, you're not going to be able to attract a lot of people who would have the cutting edge skills, the ones who are right out of school, who are excited about teaching because they've got loans and they got to pay stuff off. So you may not be able to get the best and the brightest. So how do you do that? How do you put together a good top quality program and staff it properly?
In terms of the first question about how you convince people to invest in pre-K, it's important for us to let people know that the benefits and the payoff of pre-K are really in the long term. We have unfortunately gotten accustomed to attempting to measure success in school with standardized test scores at the end of a school year. That's obviously not age appropriate for young children. You can't really do it, and if you do, it doesn't really mean anything. Young children can't really take standardized tests. And the skills that they're learning are things that are very hard to quantify, like curiosity and persistence and excitement about learning. So it takes some time to see the payoff. Now, fortunately, in some model programs like in New Jersey and in Boston, there are long-term studies that are looking at how kids are doing in third grade, fifth grade, you know, all the way up through elementary school, and they will continue on, that are showing that kids who went to high-quality pre-K actually are doing better on test scores, and they're less likely to be retained in grade, they're less likely to be placed in special education, and those kinds of remedial programs actually cost more than it's costing us to invest in pre-K for young children. And then if you follow it out to adulthood and you see that these kids are more successful in life as adults, we even now have studies showing that they are more positive parents if they have, for example, gone to Head Start, then that's where you really start to see the cost savings. And that's where you really start to see this ratio of a return on investment of something like $8 or $10 for every $1 invested. And those things pay off for society in terms of mental health and crime and public assistance. So even for people who don't have young children or who will never have young children, it's important to remember that these things make society better off, and so they're better for all of us. Now, in terms of the second piece about how do you create a high-quality program, there are places that are doing some really interesting things in terms of investing in teacher development. And we now know that one of the best things for teachers, one of the things that makes them successful is for them to have coaches who come into the classroom regularly and observe them and see what they're doing well and what they're struggling with. And these are veteran educators, master teachers, who have all kinds of strategies and effective tips and things that teachers can use with young children. And sometimes little kids, even if you're well-trained, little kids have a way of just throwing challenges at you that you never saw coming. And so when you have an experienced person who can be a support, then that's incredibly helpful for effective teaching. And I have been watching that process play out in Boston over the last couple of years, where some great coaches have been going into community centers and really helping them improve what they were doing for kids. And so in the short term, while we're working towards a system where we improve teacher training and compensation, coaching for the teachers who are already there is a really good strategy.
Okay, talk about some of the skills that are being learned in there. You mentioned socialization and hanging out with people you might not choose to hang out with normally. But there's also math and academic subjects, which, again, I think a lot of people are saying, well, maybe they ought to not necessarily have that kind of pressure put on them. So what are they learning academically in a pre-K program?
In a good pre-K program, kids are encouraged to be curious and encouraged to solve problems. So we don't want to see young children being drilled with flashcards or tested or expected to memorize a list of words. That's not only age appropriate, it doesn't actually work. They don't retain that information in the long term. But that's not to say that they aren't learning vocabulary and math, for example. And as researchers are studying more and more about learning to read, they've learned that a couple of things are particularly important before kids get to the stage of learning to read. One is having a well-developed vocabulary, hearing in interactive conversations, hearing lots of different words, using lots of different words. And another is background knowledge. It turns out that when kids start reading, if they understand the context of what they're reading and they can reference their kind of mental encyclopedia, it's very helpful for them. They need to have some experience of the world, and pre-K can be a great way to open up the world and give kids those kinds of experiences. You mentioned math, and as I was writing the book, one of the pieces that was most fascinating to me was watching some really good math curricula in action that were developed specifically for 3- and 4-year-olds. And one in particular, which is called Building Blocks and is used in Boston, does an excellent job of really teaching children how to think about problems and how to analyze what they're looking at. So we all know that 3- and 4-year-olds can learn to count, and that's going to be helpful for them to know what numbers look like, but they're capable of so much more. And when you do it in a playful way, you can teach them all kinds of sophisticated concepts. So, for example, in one of the classrooms I visited, the kids were doing an activity called number pizzas, where the teacher and the child each had a paper plate, and then they had little red chips that were supposed to be pepperonis. And the teacher would make a pizza and then say to the child, can you make your pizza have the same number of pepperonis as mine? Or can you make it have more pepperonis? And it was this really fun, hands-on way for them to learn the concepts of same and more and less. And to a child, that's just fun. That's just a playful game, but they're also learning something from it. And I think when we have this debate about whether children should be learning skills like reading and math in pre-K, we forget that a lot of us actually do that in our daily lives with them. So counting how many stones you walk on when you're walking up a path, or pointing out on a sign when you see that Suzanne's name starts with the same letter as stop on the stop sign. Learning is really a part of what young children do day to day. And so good pre-K programs just do more of that.
But again, it's got to be structured and it's got to be organized in a way, right? I mean, you talked about curricula, but you were talking about math curricula, but wouldn't there need to be something if this is truly the most important year? Shouldn't there be something? I mean, I hate to say something like the No Child Left Behind, but you know, whatever it is, so that there's a nationwide set of standards and goals that we're trying to achieve with kids of that age.
That's a really important question, because unfortunately sometimes we get into this false dichotomy between learning and free play. And so on the one hand, you have classrooms that are doing super structured, kids should sit in rows, they should listen, they should regurgitate what I say. And then on the other end, total free play, where kids are just doing whatever they're interested in. And the truth is that neither of those things is going to get our children to where we want them to be. All children do need plenty of opportunities for free play, and good classrooms have some time for that. But good classrooms also have a set of intentional learning goals in mind. And we do want teachers to guide children towards knowing what letters are and beginning to identify the sounds that certain letters make and beginning to understand science and the concept of things that float and things that sink, or why something balances on a fulcrum. So those kinds of skills aren't going to be developed unless teachers have them in mind. And a good teacher introduces those things in ways that are playful and that are hands-on and that are fun and doesn't push kids to do things they're not ready for, but is there to scaffold those things and to ask the kinds of questions and set up the activities that are going to lead kids to that knowledge.
I have about 30 seconds. How do you measure whether a program is a success or not?
That's a difficult question, and it's an important one. You can't quantify it with a standardized test. What you can do is you can quantify it in the child's excitement, curiosity, and positivity about school and about learning. That really tells you a lot about whether your program's successful.
Suzanne Buffard's the author of The Most Important Year, Pre-Kindergarten and the Future of Our Children. Thank you, Suzanne. Thanks very much. It was great to have you. Very informative. Is there a website people can find out more about you or the book?
Yes, you can go to my website, which is SuzanneBouffard.com. I'm also on Twitter at Suzanne Bouffard. And the book is The Most Important Year. And you can find it wherever books are sold.
And it's B-O-U-F-F-A-R-D. And our website, of course, is MrDad.com. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.